Hello and welcome from Holden Village. Today is June 21st, the year 2000. And in the Creekside Room this afternoon, Paul Olson will present great stories we need to know. The need to know black poets, do they speak for us? And this is number OLP 2000-8. So let's join Paul now for that session.
Hi, my name is Paul Olson. We're going to look at some African American poetry. I'm going to read some. I'm going to ask you questions. The stand won't hold my book, so I have to move down like that. And up like that. Y'all know Robert Frost is?
Yes.
He has the beginning poem in his anthology. It goes, I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear I may. I shan't be gone long. You come too? I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come too. What do you feel?
Jack Ledbetter.
Huh?
Jack Ledbetter.
No, I feel drawn into it. I feel like coming
sure.
With him.
You come too.
Yeah.
And anything else? What's he going to do? I'm going out.
Not much of anything.
Yeah, that's right. Not much of anything. Clean the pasture spring? I mean, pasture springs have been out there for, you know, eons. They didn't need anybody to clean them. I'll stop and rake the leaves away I want and wait to watch the water clear I may. So he's going to rake it off and the water be stirred up and just sit there and watch the particles settle. And then he's going to go out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. And calves, you know, before people put them in pens, didn't need to get fetched. So you feel drawn in, and he's not going to do much of anything. So my favorite question then is, so what? And he said, you come too. I'm going to go do nothing that really needs to get done. What?
A whole lot of nothing.
A whole lot of nothing. Well, let me share a line with you that I use with students. In my teaching back home, and that is, this might be the least practical course, I tell students, and you just have a session now, the least practical course you'll ever take. But by being the least practical, it maybe is the most practical. It's not going to help you balance your checkbook. It's not going to give you a physical fitness program. It's not going to help you in nutrition, but it's going to strike to the core of our humanness. Animals, we think anyway, don't watch the water clear, don't seem to have a sense of what's beautiful and what isn't. They can do a lot of things that we didn't used to give them credit for, but beauty doesn't seem to be one of them. So this impractical journey through poetry today, but I'm going to add a dimension for us since everybody in this room is white, and that is there's a practical step too, and that is, is it possible through the language of the poet to get to somebody else's experience? And if you're at my session yesterday, and I don't know who was or who wasn't, I did give a quiz and take a roll, but I lost it. We talked a little bit about language and how getting to the core, the very specific images of language, of the experience, that's what communicates the truth. So an example I used then was, I'm going to write home to my mom when I first go to college and say, dear mom, my roommate's great. And she writes back, what do you mean, he supplies you with heroin, or what does that mean? Great. I'm being absurd, of course. But great doesn't do anything for us because it's so abstract and so general and so vague. So then we try to get down into deeper levels of the truth, of the human experience, and we got to go, and our only way to do that is through words. And most of us aren't very good at that. So, I hope, at least I do, we can turn to poets. And you wouldn't be here if you weren't interested in hearing what poets say and how they get to the core of experience, because they can pick and somehow find that image that goes to our My phrase is bone marrow, our guts.
I was going to say, if you've ever been to Robert Frost Homestead, you feel the relationship to what you just recited to us.
Really? You come too?
Yeah.
I haven't been there either. This
Well, it's a lovely. The bluebirds are just everywhere, and it's a nice big pasture land. It's a gorgeous place.
Yeah. Well, now I've got another trip on my docket to, you know, plans what things to do. Another happens to be white poet. Has something to say about art that I like too. And in the setting is simply there's an old soldier sitting down on a chair out in front of the general store. And the poem by Edgar Lee Masters begins with just an abstract statement. We are voiceless in the presence of realities. We cannot speak. A curious boy asks an old soldier sitting in front of the grocery store, "How did you lose your leg?" And the old man is struck with silence, or his mind flies away because he cannot concentrate it on Gettysburg. It returns jocosely, and he says, "A bear bit it off." The boy wonders, while the old soldier dumbly, feebly lives over the flashes of guns, the thunder of cannon, the shrieks of the slain, and himself lying on the ground. The hospital knives, the surgeons, and the long days in bed. But if he could describe it all, he would be an artist. But if he were an artist, there would be deeper wounds which he could not describe. What do you get from that? The artist, I just said that was my argument about we're going to take the language of the artist and the images that she creates, and we're going to go to those, and we're going to get to the core of human experience. Then we have a poet saying, but if he was an artist, there'd be deeper wounds which he could not describe.
Don't be an artist.
That might be it, exactly, right? Somehow, there are even experiences that you can't get to with words, is it true? That's my question, I guess, for you. Can we get to the experience? And I'll share some of these with you, and we'll just kind of zip through them pretty fast, and I did everything. Get my glasses. The eye doctor told me when I hit 40, I'd need glasses. And I have 39 now. Yeah, right. Okay. For a lady I know, she even thinks that up in heaven her class lies late and snores, while poor black cherubs rise at 7 to do celestial chores. That's all it is. She even thinks that up in heaven her class lies late and snores, while poor black cherubs rise at 7 to do celestial chores. I'm always interested in your feedback. Thoughts, feelings, simple? That's probably not a great poem. But
who's the poem?
The poet? Is that what you said? Yeah. County Cullen. The Harlem Renaissance is a period of somewhere but like 1910 to 1929. It sort of ends with a stock market crash. It is the time when there's a lot of southern movement. I mean, the blacks from the south move north to get jobs. The war is going on, you know, the World War I. And so they call it a renaissance because there's a special interest and excitement about lots of things. Black poetry, the exotic black dancers. And maybe that's worth it, we won't get into it, but it's worth just throwing out, I think, that with the attention given to the black artists, the dancers, the singers, the poets, even some novelists get some more attention, and there is this black movement in the kind of the white intelligentsia, the avant-garde kind of intellects that pay attention to this. The poets, I think, try to counter that. Hey, we're not here for your entertainment. We're not here about dance and just jazz and music and to be exotic for you. We're gonna make some points about American society. So poetry is for these guys and gals is meant to teach. Well, again, she even thinks that up in heaven her class lies late and snores.
upper class?
Social class, I think.
Social class.
Right. It was just like it is here. I love the image of the cherubs.
Yeah, poor black cherubs rise at seven to do celestial chores.
Nothing's going to change for me.
Yeah. And how ingrained is this whole notion of the social hierarchy and the racial hierarchy? She even thinks it up in heaven. And I bet you, most of you know, the most important supporter of segregation and before that slavery, the most important institution in America was
church.
So this becomes even kind of a religious notion. Well, we'll move faster than that, but you'll get to take them away. This is kind of a legend. The poet is Sterling Brown. In lots of these people, I'll ask, anybody ever heard of Sterling Brown? He's very good, and I'm not surprised you haven't heard of him. That's our educational system doesn't do that. This is about Frankie and Johnny, and Frankie is a woman, a girl, and Johnny is a boy, and you'll get it. Frankie was a half-wit, Johnny was a nigger. Frankie liked to pain poor creatures as a little one, and kept a crazy love of torment when she got bigger. Johnny had to slave it and never had much fun. Frankie liked to pull wings off of living butterflies. Frankie liked to cut long angleworms in half. Frankie liked to whip curs and listen to their drawn-out cries. Frankie liked to shy stones at the brindle calf. Frankie took her pappy's lunch weekdays to the sawmill. Her pappy, red-faced cracker with a cracker's thirst. Everyone know what cracker is? Yeah, a white honky. Right. Her pappy, red-faced cracker with a cracker's thirst, beat her skinny body and reviled the hateful imbecile. Remember, Frankie was a half-wit. She screamed at every blow he struck, but tittered when he cursed. Frankie had to cut through Johnny's field of sugar corn, used to wave at Johnny, who didn't pay no mind, had to work like 50 from the day that he was born, and weren't no cracker hussy gonna put his work behind. But every day, Frankie swung along the cornfield lane, and one day Johnny helped her partly through the wood. Once he had dropped his plow lines, he dropped them many times again, though his mother didn't know it, else she'd have whipped him good. Frankie and Johnny were lovers. Oh, Lordy, how did they love. But one day, Frankie's pappy, by a big log, laid him low to find out what his crazy Frankie had been speaking of. He found that what his gal had muttered was exactly so. Frankie, she was spindly, limbed with corn silk on her crazy head. Johnny was a nigger who never had much fun. They swung up Johnny on a tree and filled his swinging hide with lead, and Frankie yowled hilariously when the thing was done. What, we'll go as fast as you want to, but any response?
That was a black poet?
Pardon me?
That was a black poet?
That was a black poet, Sterling Brown. Why did you ask that?
Some of the terminology, I guess.
Nigger?
Yeah, well, that and other things, and cracker, and yeah.
Yeah,
so cool. You've never been called a cracker.
Huh?
I said, if you've never been called a cracker, it's a real threat.
Yeah.
I was one of a few white guys in a black military unit. And growing up in the Midwest, I said boy one time and got jumped.
Yeah.
Because I didn't realize it was a racial slur.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is.
It was, yeah. Yeah.
I was questioning, why did you think that he saw the girl as the imbecile? Maybe why is that the character?
Why did he pick in this legend?
does that say something about the racism that we have as well?
I think so, and I guess I'll turn it. I'm not afraid to answer that question.
No.
But I'm more interested in what you think. Why not just a white girl, but an imbecile, a half-wit, he calls her that later.
It would have been unlikely that another white girl would have done what she did, I think. And I'm not sure of the timing.
Carried out a relationship.
Yeah, that's probably true.
that he must have been taking advantage of her.
Yeah, good. She would never do this, this happened. And so, now, and how is she treated by her father?
Yeah, I mean, he
abuses her. Mm-hmm. And yet when this happens, they string, you know, it's a lynching. They string him up and shoot him.
The expression he dropped his plow lines many times, I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah. Good point. What does that probably say? He's out there working and she comes
by. Yeah,
that he dropped his plow lines when she came in view. And they talked about the log and his father laid him low. I didn't understand the question.
Apparently, his father was hiding behind a log. You see, this crazy girl, or this retarded young gal, would say, hey, I apparently told her. And he went to hide behind his log to see if it was really true.
Okay.
And he said, and he found out it was so. But he drops the plow lines many times.
Yeah.
Consensual?
Sure.
But she's been going through this yard for, or this field for, weeks, and finally he drops the plow lines and stops.
But said she needed help or something to help her through the wood.
To help her through the wood, part way through the wood, I think the phrase was, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look at them quickly, but again, we'll go as fast as you want to, and there's some of them are worthy of more discussion than others are. And then maybe at the end, we'll, you know, what have we collectively been shown? One of the things that I believe about teaching poetry is that we want to get across the notion that poetry is not only about something, but it's an experience in itself. And that's a hard thing we just want to see if it happens as we go further through this.
There's so much cruelty in that poem.
Yeah, whoa, isn't there?
Yeah, and I'm just feeling hurt. Every night, a new line, I felt hurt all over again.
Yeah. Well, that's good. You're experiencing, I don't want you to be hurt, but you're experiencing that what the poetry does. That's a great point. Okay, we'll go a little further. And this is very different, but it's the Black experience, and we'll see what it does. This is Langston Hughes, probably the most famous of the Renaissance period poets. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood and human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like rivers. Nothing violent. It's beautiful, little poem.
But he's talking about the soul of his race, not his personal. He's talking about we were there when this happened, we were there when that happened.
Yep.
Over time, quite a long time.
How about African heritage, proud?
Sure. Yes.
Yeah, and this is my soul. And you don't need to know this, but could be you got it. But in the Harlem Renaissance, this was a time when the poets and the leaders, the intellectual Black people, are pushing Black pride. We talk about it in the 60s, you know, Black pride and the Afro haircut and so on, but way before that. And this is one of the big movements that gets that started, is that, and we're not going to hide our slave heritage. We're not going to hide our African heritage. And if you've ever looked at an old Ebony magazine or anything that was typically a Black magazine, you'd find hair straighteners and skin lighteners and that kind of stuff for sale. And the whole kind of, the word in literature anyway seems to pop up a lot of times is the whole notion of assimilation. And by assimilating, I'm going to have to deny this African heritage. Well, this turns that on its head and says, no, I'm not going to do that. This one's a little longer, and we'll see. Not only, though, do the poets address their own heritage and celebrate that, they also address the social and governmental and political structure of the society they live in. This one is called Advertisement for the Waldorf Astoria. And it's Langston Hughes again. Look, see what Vanity Fair says about the new Waldorf Astoria. All the luxuries of private home. Now, won't that be charming when the last flop house has turned you down this winter? Furthermore, quote, it is far beyond anything hitherto attempted in the hotel world. It cost $28 million. The famous Oscar Schirsky is in charge of banqueting. Alexander Gusteau is chef. It will be a distinguished background for society. So, when you've got no place else to go, homeless and hungry ones, choose the Waldorf as the background for your rags. Or do you still consider the subway after midnight good enough? Rumors, take a room at the new Waldorf, you down-and-outers, sleepers in charity flop houses where God pulls a long face and you have to pray to get a bed. They serve well board at the Waldorf Astoria. Look at this menu, will you? Gumbo Creole, crab meat and cassolette, boiled brisket of beef, small onions and cream, watercress salad, peach melba. Have lunch in there this afternoon, all you jobless. Why not? Dine with some of the men and women who got rich off of your labor, who clipped coupons with clean white fingers because your hands dug coal, drilled soft stone, sewed garments, poured steel, to let other people draw dividends and live easy. Hughes, at this time, it's pretty clear, but now you don't even know this, but you can sense it, is already drawn to the Communist Party. But not because he's a revolutionary, but because those lots of these poets have given up on the social structure as it is to solve the historical problems that have been handed down. And so you can sense that communism there. Or haven't you had enough yet of the soup lines and the bitter bread of charity? Walk through Peacock Alley tonight before dinner and get warm anyway. You've got nothing else to do. Evicted families, all you families put out in the street. Apartments in the towers are only $10,000 a year. This is 1922. Three rooms and two baths. Move in there until times get good and you can do better. $10,000 and $1 are about the same to you, aren't they? Who cares about money with a wife and kids homeless and nobody in the family working? Wouldn't a duplex high above the street be grand with a view of the richest city in the world at your nose? A lease, if you prefer, or an arrangement terminable at will? Oh, Lord, I done forgot Harlem. Say, you colored folks hungry a long time in 135th Street. They got swell music at the Waldorf Astoria. It sure is a mighty nice place to shake hips in, too. There's dancing after supper in a big warm room. It's cold as hell on Lenox Avenue. All you've had all day is a cup of coffee. Your pawn shop overcoat's a ragged banner on your hungry frame. You know, downtown folks are just crazy about Paul Robeson. Maybe they'll like you, too. Black mob from Harlem. There's the exotic black, the great singer, and we're going to celebrate that. But how about the common folk? The poets speak to that. Drop in at the Waldorf this afternoon for tea. Stay for dinner. Give Park Avenue a lot of darky color, free for nothing. Ask the junior leaguers to sing a spiritual for you. They probably know them better than you do. And their lips won't be chapped with cold after they step out of their closed cars in the undercover driveways. Hallelujah, undercover driveways. My soul's a witness for that Waldorf Astoria. 1,000 nigger section hands keep the roadbed smooth, so investments in railroads pay ladies with diamond necklaces staring at certain murals. Thank God Almighty. And 1,000,000 niggers bend their backs on rubber plantations for rich behinds to ride on thick tires to the theater guild tonight. My soul's a witness. And here we stand, shivering in the cold in Harlem. Glory be to God, the Waldorf Astoria's open. So get proud and rear back, everybody. The new Waldorf Astoria's open. Special siding for private cars from the railroad yards. You ain't been there yet? 1,000 miles of carpet and 1,000,000 bathrooms. What's the matter? You haven't seen the ads in the papers? Didn't you get a card? Don't you know they specialize in American cooking? Ankle on down to 49th Street and Park Avenue. Get up off that subway bench tonight with the Evening Post for cover. Come on out of that flophouse. Stop shivering your guts out all day on street corners under the L. Jesus, ain't you tired yet? Christmas card. Hail Mary, Mother of God, the new Christ child of the revolution's about to be born. Kick hard, red baby, in the bitter womb of the mob. Somebody put an ad in Vanity Fair. Quick, call Oscar of the Waldorf, for Christ's sake. It's almost Christmas, and that little girl, turned whore because her belly was too hungry to stand it anymore, wants a nice clean bed for the Immaculate Conception. Listen, Mary, Mother of God, wrap your newborn babe in the red flag of revolution. The Waldorf Astoria is the best manager we've got, the best manger we've got. For reservations, telephone EL53000. It's pretty clever, if nothing else, but what?
response. All those images of, and what works the hardest, the best of me? A bad question. What images do you remember? That's a better question.
I like the American food they specialize in.
Yeah.
Grits and gumbo.
Yeah, right. American food, and we have all that fancy high. Right, very good.
$1 and $10,000 is the same thing
to you. It's the same thing to you, right. I remember a guy offered me a good deal on a Mercedes-Benz. I said, thank you. But that's a good deal. But I've got my little mountain bike here. I'll take that. Good. Anything else?
Pawn shop overcoat. Yeah. Why?
So all, very good. All those images of wealth and poverty juxtaposed. This is America. I won't read it, but Langston Hughes has another one. The title is better than the whole poem. The poem's good too, but I too sing America. But can I participate if I'm a part of this? And this addresses that at length. Then another one it's interesting because lots of you, well, not many of you are old enough to have heard Winston Churchill said this, and didn't footnote it, by the way, during World War II. See if you recognize it, and then I'll tell you about it. Well, I'll tell you about it ahead of time. It's Claude McKay. He's another one of these Renaissance poets, a novelist, actually better known probably for his criticism. But this poem, If We Must Die, was made famous by Winston Churchill. You can see Churchill saying this about World War, you know, the war against the Germans, but you can also imagine why it's written by a black poet. If we must die, let it not be like hogs hunted and penned in an inglorious spot, while round us bark the mad and hungry dogs, making their mock at our accursed lot. If we must die, oh, let us nobly die, so that our precious blood may not be shed in vain. Then even the monsters we defy shall be constrained to honor us, though dead. O kinsmen, we must meet the common foe. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, and for their thousand blows, deal one death blow. What though before us lies the open grave? Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. It's a rally of the troops. But now, you know, if you didn't know them, it wasn't written by a black writer. What's he talking about? What are the odds?
Poor.
Poor, for sure. Good. He even has the number. Though far outnumbered, let us show us brave, for their thousand blows, we'll fight back one. And poets understand, don't they, the power structure, but the symbols for that power, too. You'll get this one. And again, fire away. I won't go any faster than you want me to or that you want to. Paul Laurence Dunbar, famous poet, photographer, wrote a book, The Sport of the Gods. That's his novel, but he also published a photographer, poet at the turn of the century. One of the slave studies, a very bad one, by the way, talked about the contented slave. It's Ulrich Phillips's Negro Slavery. That's titled The Negro Slave, American Negro Slavery. And one of his main theses is that slaves are really content and that things are okay down there. And here's Paul Laurence Dunbar maybe explaining what that's about. We wear the mask that grins and lies, that hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts we smile and mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but O great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but O, the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise, we wear the mask. Wow.
Don't let them know they beat us.
Yeah.
Well, the comment about singing has been heard before.
Sure.
That's why we sing and cover our heart and happiness.
Yeah. There's a beautiful chapter. If you read anything, any sociology you would read about the African American experience, the first thing to read would be The Souls of Black Folk, kind of a tough book in some places, but this one book called Of the Sorrow of Songs is about music and why slaves sing. And it really gets to the heart, as words can, as best as words can, to what slave songs and spirituals are about.
It's also being a good black person so that they stay out of trouble. We wear the mask of we're nice, we're happy, don't mind us, we're doing just fine here, which keeps them from getting beaten or killed or accused of rape.
Yep, very good. It hides our cheeks, shades our eyes. Very good.
Well, who's the author in that?
That's Paul Lawrence Dunbar.
No, of the Sorrow of Songs.
W-E-B-U-B-O-I-S. And of the Sorrow of Songs is in the book called The Souls of Black Folk.
Okay.
Let's see, am I still in the same book? Yep. You'll like this one, too. Anybody know that? Lorraine Hansberry's famous play about Southside Chicago, Raisin in the Sun, Well, here's where the title comes from. And now you can all go home and say, I know where the title of Lorraine, because when that comes up in conversation, it comes up all the time, doesn't it? Hey, who wrote? Okay. This is called Lenox Avenue Mural. It's Langston Hughes. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? There's much more, I'll keep going. But all the images of the dream deferred, and before we feel these coming up and with specific images, what's your notion so far? What are you feeling so far? What happens to a dream deferred? Would it dry up like a raisin in the sun?
Withers away.
Yeah, good. Withers away, and I'm not going to dream anymore. It stinks like rotten meat. That what happens to a dream deferred? What happens?
Becomes repulsive.
Yeah, because I'm not going to achieve this. And or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet.
Just build that barrier. Just can't get to it.
Can't get to it. And it's sugar and syrupy and
tastes terrible.
There was one in the time there about a sore.
What?
There was one right after the raisin in the sun about a sore.
Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or or fester like a sore, and then run? And the last one, maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Well, that's kind of if poems are written with thesis sentences, there is one. And then the last phrase, or does it explode?
Yeah.
And there's Watts in Detroit and Newark and Chicago in the 60s. Well, the poem goes on, or does it explode? Good morning, Daddy. I was born here, he said. Watched Harlem grow until colored folks spread from river to river across the middle of Manhattan, out of Penn Station, dark tenth of a nation, planes from Puerto Rico and holds of boats. Chico, up from Cuba, Haiti, Jamaica, in buses marked New York, from Georgia, Florida, Louisiana, to Harlem, Brooklyn, the Bronx, but most of all, to Harlem, dusky sash across Manhattan. I've seen them come dark, wondering, wide-eyed, dreaming, out of Penn Station, but the trains are late, the gates open, but there are bars at each gate. What happens to a dream deferred? Daddy, ain't you heard? I said to my baby, baby, take it slow. I can't, she said, I can't, I got to go. There's a certain amount of traveling in a dream deferred. In Lorraine Hansberry's play, The Raisin in the Sun, one of the things that happens is that one of the main characters has a dream, and I'm going to get this, I'm going to buy this liquor store, we're going to make money, I'm going to get out of this slumlord, or this slum apartment, and I'm going to buy a house out here, and I'm going to buy my wife some pearls. There's a certain amount of traveling in the dream deferred. When he can't do it, he's going to leave. I can't meet the expectations that I have and that society gives me. That's true in Langston Hughes' wonderful novel called Not Without Laughter as well. The father's away because he can't meet. There's a certain amount of traveling in the dream deferred. Lulu said to Leonard, I want a diamond ring. Leonard said to Lulu, you won't get a goddamn thing. A certain amount of nothing in the dream deferred. Daddy, 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 all I want is you. You can have me, baby, but my loving days is through. A certain amount of impotence in a dream deferred.
three parties on my party line, but that third party, Lord, ain't mine. There's liable to be confusion in a dream deferred. From river to river, uptown and down, there's liable to be confusion when a dream gets kicked around. You talk like they don't kick dreams around downtown. I expect they do, but I'm talking about Harlem to you. Letter, dear Mama, time I pay rent and get my food and laundry, I don't have much left. But here is $5 for you to show you I still appreciate you. My girlfriend send her love and say she hopes to lay eyes on you sometime in life. Mama, it has been raining cats and dogs up here. Well, that is all, so I will close. Your son, baby, respectable as ever, Joe. Between two rivers north of the park, like darker rivers, the streets are dark. Black and white, gold and brown, chocolate custard pie of a town. Dream within a dream, our dream deferred. Good morning, Daddy. Ain't you heard? I say, wow, dear Mama, the time I see you again. The separation of families, and it reflects on the whole history of the Black experience and the movement from the north, or the south to the north.
Do you have some women's voices to share with us so that we can kind of hear their perspective?
I do. I do. And I can skip right to that.
Can I ask you a question about that poem?
Yep.
I know I read it in high school, and I want to even say, like, in the Norton anthology of, like, modern poetry, and we're just talking this because we both have, we only heard the first part of it, like, until Or Does It Explode? And I've never even heard that there was a rest.
Yeah.
Rest of the poem. What's that about? Like, is that normal? Or... it seems very okay to me.
It's not okay.
So the first part, you don't even know that it has anything to do with the Black experience. It's just like...
The first part wasn't, and she used that in the play.
Yes, it's recited in the play.
Yeah.
And to explode, and then you go into the
apartment. In the play, I'm going to jump on your word normal. I don't know. I have seen it anthologized the way you describe it, with most of it left out. I'll share with you another experience I had as a high school teacher. I was looking for, in my first year out of college, I was looking for, I teach a poetry unit, and I was looking for poems that could turn on, you know, these football jocks that wanted to do that poetry, don't give me that crap. And no, it's not all about flowers and stuff. And, well, anyway, somebody gave me a poem that goes like this. Do you remember how you won that last race? How you flung your body at the start? How your spikes ripped the senders in the stretch? How you catapulted through the tape? Do you remember? Don't you think I lurched with you out of those starting holes? Don't you think my sinews tightened at those first few strides? And as you flew into the stretch, was not all my thrill of 1,000 races in your blood? And at your final drive through the finish, did not my shout tell of the triumphant ecstasy of victory? Live as I've taught you to run. It's a short dash. Dig your starting holes firm and deep. Lurch out of them into the straightaway with all the power that's in you. Run straight, run high, run hard, save nothing, and finish with an ecstatic burst that carries you hurtling through the tape to victory. Yeah, cool. Well, I got that handed to me by a colleague. At the bottom it said anonymous. This was 1965. When I went to graduate school and finished my, and got into African American literature, I met a guy named Frank Horn who wrote that poem. And I bring up that example to kind of further support your, they put in this part of the poem, but not the whole thing.
Was he African American, Frank Horn?
Yeah, and Frank, yeah, thank you. Frank Horn is Black. And but how long had this been passed on? Why had this been, I don't have any answers for that, but I know that it happened. And that Frank Horn becomes anonymous with a poem that's really quite fine, isn't it? So normal, it's as normal as getting something that says anonymous. And I've looked through the poetry anthologies here at Holden, and most of, we get our library put together in most cases. There, none of the anthologies have African Americans included. But they're old. I didn't either. And if, I don't know if anybody here has heard me say this, I was done with my master's degree.
I'd been at the University of Oregon, the University of Minnesota, and Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. I had a master's degree in English, a double major, history and English, as an undergraduate, and I'd never heard of any black writer. Well, it, my fault, maybe, but I think that's what we call institutional racism. I mean, the canon and the curriculum is set up by them. Well, some women.
Can I say something?
You sure can.
I heard Langston Hughes in an elementary college education class.
You heard him?
Well, it was presented to us by the professor.
Oh, yeah. Good for him, for that professor.
She.
Huh?
She.
Good for that professor. Good for that Minnesota professor. There aren't very many of them. There weren't very many. It's different now. We got a long ways to go, but it surely is better. It's one of the victories that people who have cared have achieved, I think, with trying to change the system. Here is a modern. Before I do this, I'll give you one. This is Wendell Brooks. Wendell Brooks is the Illinois poet laureate, of course, a woman. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or no hair. The singers and workers that never handled the air. You'll never neglect them or beat them or silence or buy with the sweet. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb and scuttle off ghosts that come. You'll never leave them, controlling your luscious sigh in return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim killed children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted and lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, your aches, your deaths, if I poisoned the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. But why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you were dead. Or rather, instead, you were not made. But that too, I am afraid, is faulty. What shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you lived, you died. It's just that you never giggled or planned or cried. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly. And I loved you all. That's a woman's voice. Respond.
Very powerful.
Pretty powerful. Want to have that abortion, did she?
At the time.
She didn't know.
Even in my deliberateness, the finality of the act, in my deliberateness, you can't have a half an abortion.
Well, there's another story there. I mean, there's so many stories in that story. And most women who have abortions know that story as well as the other story. They know why they had to do it.
Yep.
They also carry with them forever that pain.
All those images of what could have been. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb.
Mother's snack with the mother's
eye. Sure.
That was a great line.
Yeah. Great line. Return for a snack of them. And we all did it if you got kids, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You look in and look, and it's the only time they look good. You go there and look at that kid, and oh, look how sweet he looks or she looks, and return for a snack of them because tomorrow they're going to be hell again.
Yeah.
Return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. Yeah.
Great
one. I love
the other story.
And there are 2 times 20 stories.
Mm-hmm.
And is it about the economic conditions? Is it about the social conditions? Is it about the personal? All, I mean, yes, to all of that. What made it happen? But I loved you, and I knew you, though faintly, and I loved you.
It's about mourning a decision.
What?
It's about mourning a decision.
Mourning, yeah. This is grief.
She's haunted by ghosts. I mean, she comes right on the side, you know.
I have contracted. She assumes the responsibility. I have eased. How many of you out there today, right now, tonight, thought of, I'm a man delivering this poem, I have eased the dim deers at the breasts that could never suck? Did you think about it?
Yes.
Most people don't. And I understand that. I mean, of course I do. But most people don't. And my argument about that, not against you, but about that, is that I think great art transcends racial and gender difference. And we women connect to that, I'm sure. I mean, I've talked to lots of women about it, differently than men do. Women who have had abortions connect to that in even different ways. Women who have taken stands one way or the other about abortion, the political, social, religious kind of stands, I mean, connect to that. We all connect to it differently. But something there in good art transcends. And the title of this thing on the kiosk says, Can Black Poets Speak For Me? Now, obviously, I believe they can, or I wouldn't be doing this stuff, but... Then you decide that, can they? And can a woman speak for a man? Can a man speak for a woman? Not always, and it's different. But the answer still is, yeah. Because I think great art transcends. Well, here's some more women. And I'm loaded here, 37. You'll like this one. I don't have all three of these books memorized, by the way, so. And,
but what you do have memorized is very good. Yeah.
This is called Summer Words of a Sister Addict, only it's Sista, S-I-S-T-U-H.
Who's the poet?
This is Nikki Giovanni, and what do I want to say about her?
Doesn't sound black.
Huh?
Doesn't sound black.
It is black. Yeah, everybody I'm reading to is black. The first day I shot dope was on a Sunday. I had just come home from church, got mad at my mother because she got mad at me. You dig? Went out, shot up behind a feeling against her. It felt good, gooder than doing it. Yeah, it was nice. I did it. I want to do it again. It felt so good. And as the sister sits in her silent, remembered high, someone leans forward, gently asks her, sister, did you finally learn how to hold your mother? And the music of the day drifts in the room to mingle with the sister's young tears, and we all sing. Want to hear that again? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you died there twice. But first, the plot of it is mom and daughter have an argument. Daughter shoots up, gets on a high. Someone leans forward, and when we get in context, it'll mean more. Someone leans forward, gently asks her sister, did you finally learn how to hold your mother? And the music of the day drifts in the room to mingle with the sister's, what's happened to her? Young tears. Mom and sister connect, your mom and daughter, on the other side. But the last line, and we all sing. One of the things that's kind of cool about revolutionary, that's the phrase for it, I think, revolutionary poets of the 60s, is that there's going to be talk about revolution, but I think that all of them come down ultimately, fundamentally, to what's most revolutionary is to begin to make our decisions about how we will live on the basis of love, not economy, not racial difference, and so on. So, here we go. The first day I shot dope was on a Sunday. I had just come home from church, got mad at my mother because she got mad at me. You dig? Went out, shot up behind a feeling against her. It felt good, gooder than doing it. Yeah, it was nice. I did it. I want to do it again. It felt so good. And as the sister sits in her silent, remembered high, someone leans forward, gently asks her, sister, did you finally learn how to hold your mother? And the music of the day drifts in the room to mingle with the sister's young tears, and we all sing. Here's one I do. This is Nikki Giovanni again. I wanted to write a poem that rhymes, but revolution doesn't lend itself to bebop. My neighbor, who thinks I hate, said, "I want to write tree poems. I like trees." Looked out from my window, saw that the schoolyard was covered with asphalt. No green, no trees grow in Manhattan. Well, then I thought, the sky. I'll do a big blue sky poem. But all the clouds have winged low since No Dick Nixon was elected. Well, then I thought again. Maybe this isn't the time for poetry at all. So I'll clean my gun and check my kerosene supply. For these are not poetic times at all. That's Nikki Giovanni, too. Let's see. This guy was at Augustana, that's where I teach. His name was Etheridge Knight. He was put in prison for dealing drugs. And in prison, he realized a sense of himself that was really a very fine poet. And if I could read my own writing, I wouldn't know what page to turn to. This is Knight in jail. Etheridge Knight, he's not in jail anymore. And you'll see from the poem how he got put in jail. He's lost. You'd be happy to know he's found now. The idea of ancestry. Taped to the wall of my cell are 47 pictures. 47 black faces, my father, mother, grandmothers, one dead, grandfathers, both dead, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, first and second, nieces and nephews. They stare across the space at me sprawling on my bunk. I know their dark eyes, they know mine. I know their style, they know mine. I am all of them and they are all of me. They are farmers, I am thief. I am me, they are thee. I have at one time or another been in love with my mother, one grandmother, two sisters, two aunts, one went to the asylum, and five cousins. I am now in love with a 7-year-old niece. She sends me letters written in large block print, and her picture is the only one that smiles at me. Excuse me. I have the same name as one grandfather, three cousins, three nephews, and one uncle. The uncle disappeared when he was 15, just took off and caught a freight, they say. He's discussed each year when the family has a reunion. He causes uneasiness in the clan. He's an empty space. My father's mother, who is 93 and who keeps the family Bible with everybody's birth dates and death dates in it, always mentions him. There is no place in her Bible for whereabouts unknown. Each fall, the graves of my grandfathers call me. The brown hills and red gullies of Mississippi send out their electric messages, galvanizing my genes. Last year, like a salmon quitting the cold ocean, leaping and bucking up his birth stream, I hitchhiked my way from L.A. with 16 caps in my pocket and a monkey in my drugs, and a monkey is his habit. I hitchhiked my way from L.A. with 16 caps in my pocket and a monkey on my back. And I almost kicked it with the kinfolks. I walked barefooted in my grandmother's backyard. I smelled the old land and the woods. I sipped corn whiskey from fruit jars with the men. I flirted with the women. I had a ball till the caps ran out and my habit came down. That night I looked at my grandmother and split my guts were screaming for junk. But I was almost contented. I had almost caught up with me. The next day in Memphis, I cracked a Croker's crib for a fix. Croker's a drugstore, and he went in. This year, there is a gray stone wall damming my stream, and when the falling leaves stir my jeans, I pace my cell or flop on my bunk and stare at 47 black faces across the space. I am all of them, and they are all of me. I am me, they are thee, and I have no sons to float in the space between. You can do whatever you want to with it, but try this once. Don't explain it. What did you feel?
Disappointment.
Sad. Disappointment. Sad. Loss.
Despair.
Despair.
Disconnected.
Disconnected.
There's struggle.
Struggle, yeah. And look, with those kinds of words, then run back to that first opening sentence, that this poetry is not just about experience, it is an experience. You felt disconnected and sad, and all the words you just gave. Stuff is worth working at and listening to. Let's see. 6:45. Hey, you're a great audience. Boy, you have wonderful sensitivities and ideas, so thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.